This is John Rosania, and I am here on podcast number 4 of The Myers Way, live with Dr. Amy Myers. Dr. Myers, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
Good, good. So today, we're going to speak all about candida. And this is a hot topic actually for years, since I've kind of gotten into health and wellness probably 10, 12 years ago. Candida was always one of these sort of catch-all words. Whenever any symptoms popped up, candida, in the background, someone was talking about candida. So, Amy, just wondering, what is it about candida, and why is everyone talking about it?
Well, first of all, I think they're really only talking about it within our wellness community. I don't think the rest of the general population is talking about it. It's probably something that's a big problem for a lot of people, and they're going to their doctors and really not getting any answers, because it's certainly nothing I learned about in medical school. So it's not something traditional doctors are thinking of. I think the reason that it's so big in our community is because it can cause so many different problems, and it really can be sort of like gluten, just a big mimicker of a lot of things, ranging from anxiety, depression, brain fog, to digestive issues, to joint pain. I mean, it's kind of one of those things that can cause a whole wide range of symptoms.
Okay, I have with me right here, I have a typical candida questionnaire. And it asks you for your history, major symptoms, and other symptoms. I just want to give a little profile of what those symptoms are. So the symptoms they have listed here, and there are 100 of them or more, but they're things from fatigue or lethargy, feeling of being drained, poor memory, feeling spacey, insomnia, muscle aches, constipation, diarrhea, impotence, loss of sexual desire or feeling, tendency to bruise easily, psoriasis, and on and on and on. There are just an unbelievable range of different symptoms here. In fact, it seems like almost every symptom somehow becomes caught up in the candida diagnosis. So what have you found, Amy, when you're working with people? What are the most common symptoms? And I guess I'm still wondering, can candida really have some connection to all of these symptoms?
So yes, let's back up a little bit. When we use the word candida, that's sort of a catch-all phrase for yeast or yeast overgrowth. Yeast is a fungus, and there are actually many, many different types of yeast and fungi that can overgrow. And we use the term candida because candida albicans, that's the scientific name for the most common type. But I certainly see people with a yeast overgrowth, and it is not actually the candida species. So,
oh really? So there is a distinction there. Candida is not just yeast in general. It's one type, and we have many types in the body?
Yes. So the thought is that we have yeast naturally in our system. As we've talked about previously in gut health, you know, our gut is lined with, we now know, there are more bacteria in us and on us than there are of our own cells. And really, you know, the ecology going on, it's sort of like a jungle down there in our gut. And there are all these different layers that we're calling a biofilm. And there can be yeast in there, parasites, good bacteria. And a problem arises when something disrupts that system. And it's sort of like the battle of the fittest. Who's ever more fit in there is going to overgrow and rule the kingdom. Now, we all hope that it's our good bacteria that's doing that, but I know we'll get into what causes, you know, a candida overgrowth in a little bit. But when that happens, that's when it becomes a problem. And there are all different species of yeast in there, or can be. And there are some good. S. boulardii, Saccharomyces boulardii, is considered to be a good yeast. It's a yeast that apparently fights yeast. Now, in my own practice, I see that sometimes can cause problems for people, and for other people can help them. But so, you know, it's fine for the purpose of our talk to call it all candida, because I tend to even do that in my own practice because people have an association with that. But not all yeast is candida. In fact, a lot of times on the testing that I do, they're not able to identify what type it is for people. But I do end up ultimately treating it all the same.
Okay, you brought up the testing there. I just actually want to just go right into that, because I know that when I'm working with clients and all, that's probably the major question that comes up. People come in with this idea that they have symptoms of candida and are really looking for a test that can at least clearly for them state whether or not they do or don't have it. So can you tell us a little bit about the testing and maybe some of the challenges with the testing? Do we know for sure? And sort of open up that space for us.
Sure. So I would say there are three main types of testing. And I did write an article on my blog about this. Again, one of those other things that, like the thyroid one, that you can kind of scan and print out and take to your doctor. And that's just on my blog at dramymyers.com. So there, if you Google on the internet, there are actually probably four types of tests because people use something called a spit test, which is at home. I don't use that. You know, I don't know the validity of that. So that's why I don't use it. But you all can Google that if you want it, something like you spit in a cup, and if your spit, you know, has these strings, and that indicates a candida overgrowth. Being a physician, I like to be a little bit more scientific about it. So I use either blood testing, stool testing, or urine testing. And in fact, sometimes I use all three. So we'll start with the blood. As we've talked about previously about the immune system, our immune system reacts in many different ways. IgE, which is immediate, IgG, which is delayed, IgA, which is in the gut, and IgM. And we can develop antibodies or markers towards candida, that it's stimulating our immune system. So you can check these markers. They're just called IgG, IgA, and IgM antibodies to candida. And that is something that can be done through a regular lab. I caution people if they're going to go to their doctor about this, please make sure that you actually get the levels of your IgG, IgA, and IgM markers in your blood. I do find that candida has the ability to suppress the immune system, which is, we kind of jumped over all the symptoms. So I know we'll get back to that after this question. And can candida really cause all those symptoms? And yes, it can either primarily or secondarily cause the symptoms that you listed out. And part of that is from the immune suppression ability of candida. And so it can suppress your fecal IgA. And in fact, all your immune markers. I often see people, one of the indicators for me on general blood work on a CBC, which is a complete blood count, is that I see people have low white blood cells. And that often can be a sign of candida. So you want to make sure that you're actually getting somebody's total IgA, IgG, and IgM markers to see that if they can even mount a response to candida. If you don't get those totals and you just get their antibodies towards candida, if the candida has suppressed their immune system, then they may not be able to mount a response. They might not be able to respond to the candida. So you would get something called a false negative, meaning that the body wasn't able to respond. They really do have the candida, but it doesn't show up in their antibody markers because their immune system was suppressed.
Gotcha. That's a really interesting one. With that blood test there, is there a way to tell, because I've had this question asked to me, is there a way to tell if, let's say, someone was eating something that created a candida bloom, let's say just right before they took a test? Is there things you do, like you don't eat certain things before the blood test, to make sure that that's something that's been continuous or not just something that's just happened?
I personally just have people, I don't like people to make any changes before they come to see me, unless it's obvious they've met me at a conference or something and they're hearing me speak and it's very obvious they have a gluten issue. You know, I want them to get off that right away. Otherwise, I really like to see people as they are. Just come in as you are, you know, with your problems, with your symptoms, and we're getting those lab tests as you are so we know what is causing it. So I don't personally have anybody alter anything prior to come see me. I just have you, you know, come as you are, come fasting, we get the blood test. Now, if you get online, a lot of people claim that the blood test is the most sensitive. After working with thousands of people, that is not what I personally have found. I have found that the stool test to be a much better marker for it. But because I can get that blood test through a regular lab, I often do check it on people as to, you know, not miss something, because we allow you to put that through your insurance. So I do check it in the blood, but I find the stool is much more sensitive. Excuse me. So, and I should clarify that when I say the stool is much more sensitive, the stool test I use is much more sensitive, a functional medicine stool test. Now, if you go to a conventional doctor and they're doing a conventional stool test, which is really just looking for parasites and bacteria, is not even looking for yeast. I mean, if yeast showed up on that test, you would have had so much that it would have been so obvious on the slide that the pathologist could not deny it, and you know they would have to remark on it. That's pretty rare. So it's not something that is even being tested for on a general conventional stool test. We've talked previously in other podcasts, and you certainly can get on my YouTube station, which is just Amy Myers, MD, and I have several videos on the stool test that I use, which is a very comprehensive stool test. It's about 4 pages long, and it uses DNA analysis, and it is very sensitive at picking up yeast overgrowth. So that is the number one test that I personally use. And the other great thing about that test is it also gives me a level of IgA in the stool, which again is a marker for your immune system. So even if somebody doesn't have candida on their stool test, or their blood, but I see a really suppressed IgA and they have a lot of symptoms for candida, again, because I know in my experience that candida can suppress your immune system, I often will treat somebody even when I just see a very suppressed IgA. So,
Okay, so that's two. And so what's the third test as well that you use?
And the third one is a urine test that looks, it's called a urine organics test. And again, I don't know that this is something you can get through a conventional lab. This is one of the functional medicine labs that I use. And it is looking for D-arabinitol, which is a, a byproduct of yeast or candida. And so it will come out in your urine if you have yeast or candida in your upper gut and your small bowel. So that would be the third test that I use. And I don't do that quite as often. Usually if they have it, it's going to show up in the stool test or the blood, but I do use that as well.
Okay. So there actually then are, I mean, you've just showed it here, that there are three sets of tests that pretty convincingly can state whether or not you have an overgrowth of yeast or not. So, because there's a lot of, you know, controversy out there around this that there aren't legitimate tests, but it sounds like here, you know, there are three tests that you use that you can get at least a good perspective on whether or not someone has overgrowth of yeast.
Yes. Okay. And then these tests come back positive pretty frequently in my practice. So I would say that they are, you know, spot on.
Okay. So then we jumped over this. So let's go back to that now. We have the testing now, and then we're going to go back to the symptoms. And, you know, I was really wondering this, about this question of there are so many symptoms that are associated with candida. Is it really possible that candida plays a role in all of these?
I believe so. And as I mentioned before, there can either be primary symptoms or what I would call a secondary symptom. So the primary symptoms would be typical symptoms that I see, which would be like a fungal, you know, infection on the skin. Rosacea is typically candida. A lot of skin issues, of course, fungus on the foot or the nails. And another primary would be sort of the brain fog, the anxiety, the depression, the mood mind type stuff. 95% of our neurotransmitters, which are the things like serotonin, epinephrine, norepinephrine, are made in our gut. 95%. What I see is people with a yeast overgrowth that suppresses their ability to make those neurotransmitters. No wonder they have anxiety. No wonder they have depression. They don't have a Prozac deficiency. They can't make their serotonin because the yeast is preventing them from doing it. The what I call a secondary symptom would be some of the things that you mentioned, like the autoimmune psoriasis on there is an autoimmune disorder. And I would call that secondary from the sense that the candida is playing a role in the leaky gut syndrome that we've talked so much about. And then the leaky gut then leads to the autoimmune. So I don't think that the, you know, candida caused the autoimmune, you know, as a direct correlation. I think that it's a secondary correlation with the it creating the leaky gut, then the gluten gets in, then we have, you know, the autoimmune disease.
So then if one treats the candida, then a lot of those ones that you call secondary symptoms tend to get a little bit lessened as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I never just, as we've talked about on previous podcasts, it's never particularly when you're coming in with something so complex as an autoimmune disease, it's never just one thing. It's not just the gluten or just the candida. So, and I never treat just one thing. I'm treating the whole picture. So it is a piece of that puzzle for sure.
Do you see any differences between men and women and their relationship with candida overgrowth?
Not to the extent of what, well, perhaps yes. I mean, I do. So, with women, some of the things that can drive candida overgrowth is estrogens, high estrogens. So either naturally high estrogens, obviously when you're pregnant, you have higher estrogens, and then synthetic estrogens like the birth control pill or even synthetic hormonal replacement for postmenopausal women. So in that sense, yes, I do see a higher proportion in women because women tend to, you know, have been pregnant. The other reason with women is when they give birth, often they're tested, well, they are tested for group B strep. Many women are positive. They get a big dose of antibiotics right before the baby's born so they don't pass that on to the baby. Boom, that could be their first setup for it. So there are certainly more risk factors when it comes to the estrogens playing a role. But other risk factors would be, you know, antibiotic usage and then, of course, diet, carbs, and sugar. And those, you know, are universal amongst men and women. I don't tend to see more of that based on the gender.
What do you, when people come into your office and if they come in with an autoimmune condition, what do you think percentage, if you just had to guess, percentage-wise of people who come in with an autoimmune also have some candida-related issue?
I've never done the breakdown of autoimmune and candida. I mean, I can just say across the board, I would say, I don't know, something like, you know, 70%, 80% of the people that I see have a candida issue.
Wow.
And as we've mentioned previously, though, I have a self-selected group. I mean, I am tending, for the most part, seeing people who are pretty sick. And so most people have a gluten issue in my clinic. Do I think this is a, you know, universal problem? Well, I mean, I think you just have to look out there. I mean, look at the television. How many, you know, commercials and ads do we have for drugs? So, and then how many people are on, you know, acid blocking medicine, which lowers your stomach acid, decreases your ability to fight off candida. You know, that's a risk factor. So I'm sure we'll get into that, you know, sort of what causes this and why is this, you know, such a problem. But it really is a problem because we live in a society where we're on these meds, we're, you know, eating highly processed diets, and then it can mimic, as we've just mentioned. You have a whole list. I've got a list of 10 on my blog that I wrote. You know, and of course, I say 10 common signs and symptoms of candida, but I have about, you know, 5 things listed on each line. So it is just a big mimicker of a lot of other things. So people are getting, I wouldn't even call it misdiagnosed or not diagnosed and put on other meds for other problems when really it was a, you know, candida issue in the beginning.
So I know with working with clients, they often come to me and say that they have a candida issue. And it's often same kind of people, I think, Amy, that, you know, are coming to you or people who have had lots of symptoms of a lot of things for a lot of years, and they're looking for a lot of answers, and they go online. And one of the things you find very quickly is, okay, candida, if I search for my symptoms, candida is probably going to be somewhere there. So let's get into some of those things that cause candida. You talked a little bit, we said before about food, and we'll get into that, but I'm really interested in some of those drugs that you just said that we're taking that also can make us more prone to having more candida.
Yeah, so the two that I've already mentioned are probably the biggest offenders. You know, anything that's going to three large offenders. One is anything that's going to block acid. So we need that stomach acid to one of the reasons that we have stomach acid, not only to digest our proteins, but is to kill off, you know, bad things that are on the foods that we eat. So when you decrease that stomach acid, then we don't have the ability to kill off those viruses, those bacteria, those parasites, those fungus on the foods that we're eating. The other would be, of course, antibiotics. Antibiotics are going to, many of them are very what we call non-specific, meaning that they're just to wipe out anything that they see in that is a bacteria. And so doing that, it, as I mentioned earlier, it's the battle of the fittest down there. It's a jungle, it's an army, and who's going to win? Well, when you come in with, you know, basically biological warfare, so to speak, with an antibiotic and it kills off all your good army, well, then who's down there to overgrow? Parasites, candida, you know, yeast, viruses, things like that. And then the third is, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just, when these non-specific antibiotics, Do they also not kill candida and parasites as well? Or I know they're also specific, and there's so many different types of bacteria and different types of yeast and all down there. So it's really this issue that when you're taking antibiotics and they're knocking out these good and bad bacteria, for some reason yeast still sort of sticks around.
Well, so because, and this just goes back to, you know, fundamental biology, which you've brought up a great point. People may not understand this because I get asked that type of question all the time. So we have different, you know, species. There's a bacteria, there's a virus, there's a fungi or yeast, and they're all very different in how they replicate and how they're fed and how they're killed. So an antibiotic is specific to bacteria. It doesn't kill a parasite and it doesn't kill a yeast. Likewise, certain yeast medications or you know, antifungal medications, they only kill the fungus. They're not killing the bacteria or the viruses, and then the parasites. And then the parasite medicine is only killing the parasites. So they're specific to the species, but within that species, there can be non-specific. So of the bacteria, and I mean, this is fundamental biology, and I can't really remember. It's like genus, species. I can't remember what the next thing is. Sorry, folks. That's so many years ago of biology. But, you know, so within that species, there are all kinds of different bacteria. And so there are some, you know, there are what we call gram-positive. They're gram-negative. They're anaerobes. They're aerobes, so ones that want air, ones that don't want air. And so then within that, there are different types of antibiotics that can be more specific. Like there's certain types of bacteria that typically are in the urinary tract when you have a bladder infection. And so they do have antibiotics that are more specific to the bladder when you know that that's what it is. And it's less likely to kill some of the bacteria in your gut. But when you don't know what it is, or it's a really bad respiratory infection, sometimes, and as more bacteria have mutated and we're getting bacterial resistance, antibiotic resistance that people might have heard about, which actually really isn't coming from the humans, it's coming from all the antibiotics that we're giving to the animals that we're eating. But that's a whole different story. Things are becoming more resistant. So as bacteria become more resistant, we have to take more powerful antibiotics that are not nearly as specific. So does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And also, then I got very interested in what you said and what you said about the animals there. So can you share a little bit more about that?
Well, again, it's like everything we talk about. There's not one this is why it's so bad or what has happened to our world. It's multifactorial. But the several theories are that we are a very clean world. We have anywhere you go, there's Purell and I don't know the names of the other antibacterial, you know, gels that there are out there. They're the antibacterial soaps that are out there. There's even when you apparently the gel that they for the soap, the main ingredient, they even line like the wrappers of foods now with that so they don't spoil and get bacteria on them. That is creating a large amount of bacterial resistance. What happens is bacteria are super smart, like they're one cellular organisms and they can easily mutate. And so we're finding that these things, they're like, oh, that antibiotic kills us. We mutate. I mean, it's evolution at its earliest form. And then they mutate and that antibiotic no longer works to kill that organism. So that is apparently, you know, one theory of why this is a big problem. Two, we are giving out antibiotics to us as humans frequently. You go to the doctor, you have a, you know, respiratory infection, 80 to 90% of those are viral. Often doctors still give an antibiotic because they want to feel like the patient thought they did something for them. You know, it's difficult to get a respiratory sample and then culture that and all that takes time. So they just hand out the antibiotics. They're cheap. It's simple. You know, they feel like there's no harm if it's not bacterial. The benefit is if it is a bacteria, then it will help it. And then there's the whole feed and animal industry that, you know, we are injecting all of these animals with these antibiotics to, you know, prevent disease. We're getting, you know, we're having them mature much more quickly. They're in small cages. They're not in the cleanest environments, and they need all these antibiotics to prevent disease. And then the you know, theory is that then we ingest these animals, and you're, you know, then inheriting those antibiotics and getting that, even though you didn't actually take the antibiotic, it's still in the system or in the meat, and then you've gotten that. So hormones as well. I mean, that's a different topic. So those are the theories out there of why. And of course the cattle and meat industry, and I mean, you know me, I do definitely eat meat, but I always eat, you know, organic, grass-fed, no antibiotics, no hormones. You know, that is one of the theories out there of why we're having all this resistance. And the interesting thing is the stool test that I do actually checks several genes for antibiotics resistance, or checks several bacteria to see if they've mutated. So there's actually a part on the test that I do. I don't typically spend too much time with it with patients, but there are about 6 different markers to tell me if the bacteria in their gut have mutated to where they are now resistant to certain antibiotics.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Okay, cool. So those are some of the drugs and all that we're taking that are making
just the final one is the birth control and the hormones that we mentioned. So that's the fourth. So the meds would be the acid blockers, the antibiotics, the hormones
and the birth control.
Yes,
that's a whole nother topic. Birth control. Sexual health, that whole thing. That's a tricky one. I'm really interested in hearing what you think about all that stuff. Okay, for another time, we'll go back now. Let's hit the food question. What are the kinds of foods that might increase our yeast overgrowth? And actually, Amy, I just realized that even before this, one thing we didn't actually get into was what does actually candida do and why it's there? You talked about it's all over the body and it's in the blood and the gut and all, but what is it actually there for?
Well, again, it's that whole, you know, we are probably just on the brink of really discovering the importance of gut health. I mean, I've mentioned it before about where I believe really the next wave of medicine is going to go. And to discover, we now know there are these biofilms in our gut and that they are layers upon layers of bacteria, parasites, fungi, and it's this interconnected weave. And as I think you mentioned at one point about the body ecology, I love the name of that, you know, the body ecology, you know, the ecology of our gut. I think of it, as I've mentioned several times, a jungle, and it's all sitting in there in a perfect, you know, in an ideal world, in a perfect balance. And I don't personally know the real mechanism of having some candida. It's to keep that system in balance. But that is, again, where I don't think we even know what all is in that biofilm. We're beginning to discover how many billions of different organisms are in that, you know, in that biofilm, and how vastly important that is to our entire health. But its actual function is in some way to keep that biofilm and that ecology in balance.
Yeah, this all this talk now about and all this research on biofilm is really, really exciting. And I've definitely been keeping up with some of that work. And I'm definitely interested in the next 10 years, especially because, you know, I was diagnosed years ago with Lyme. And one of the things that they're really speaking a lot with Lyme is biofilm and its relationship to that. So we'll see where all that stuff goes, but it's definitely a fascinating topic at the moment.
Right.
Okay, so then let's go then to foods. What are the kinds of foods that can cause an increase in some of these candida-like symptoms?
Well, candida loves carbs and sugar and fermented things. So when we think about that at its, you know, most fundamental form, it would be sugar would be something that candida would really like to eat. People don't think about it frequently, but it's even things like, you know, whole grains. You know, eventually those break down into sugars. That's what they are. They're carbohydrates. So even though it's not as quick and immediate as eating a piece of candy or something like that, they do eventually break down into that. And then, of course, alcohol, that's a simple sugar. And then when you're drinking beer or wine, not only is that a simple sugar, but you've also fermented it. So it already contains yeast in it. So that's really a no-no when you have candida or some sort of yeast overgrowth, would be simple sugars, fermented wines and beers, carbs in general. And then, you know, there's this whole thing about eating these fermented foods, the really good ones, the kombucha, the sauerkrauts. And this was probably after I wrote my article, the number one, you know, hot question that kept coming back to me. Wait a minute, you know, I'm following a paleo diet, or I'm following the body ecology diet, or I'm following the, you know, whatever it is, the carbohydrate specific diet. And I've been told to eat all this really fermented stuff to to help build the good bacteria. And my response back to that is, you know, as you and I had the conversation, I think why we connected when we first met is there's no really right answer to that. There's no, this is how you do it. I can tell you how I do it. I don't give people those things while we're sorting this out, because it's food that feeds, yes, the good bacteria, but it's also food that is fermented and is feeding those yeast as well. So, what was difficult for me when I got into functional medicine is you would go to one conference and somebody would say, oh, give Espelardi, it's a yeast, it fights yeast, and give them all this fermented stuff to build their good bacteria. And literally, if not at the same conference, certainly at the next one, somebody was saying, don't do these things. Yeast, you know, Saccharomyces is yeast and it feeds yeast. And you give them these fermented foods and it feeds both the yeast and the good bacteria. So I just kind of had to find my way of doing some one time, doing some the other. And, you know, what did I find with my patients? So I've settled on the, I don't do that. I get them off everything that's fermented. I get them off things called prebiotics, which you can buy. And we, of course, have them on our store, which come from these fermented foods, or you can eat them naturally by eating these fermented foods. But I get everybody off that stuff. I get you off kombucha. I get you off everything. In an ideal world, if you had this perfect, you know, ecology biofilm system going on in your gut, yes, you would want to eat a lot of those things because it helps promote the good bacteria. But obviously most people coming to see me are not in an ideal situation with their gut. And they've probably, if they're doing a lot of these fermented things, are only creating more problems and feeding the candida, of course, feeding the good bacteria. But I even see people who have something called small bowel bacterial overgrowth, which is just an overgrowth of even good bacteria that, again, is feeding off of these fermented foods. So it's something that I don't do until we've treated the candida, you know, sort of wiped out the system, and then we're sort of trying to rebuild it at that point.
Well, I've definitely had a similar experience with inulin and what people call prebiotics. And not as much with the sauerkrauts and all, but I know all those diets. I was on anti-candida diets for a long time. And I always found that interesting about what you said. We've definitely given people Saccharomyces boulardii quite a bit. And I just think all that debate around whether or not it's both feeding the good and the bad, definitely saw that with inulin very, very quickly on people getting really, really bloated. And some arguments saying that that's actually a good thing, some saying it's not. So I definitely have moved to a place where I err on the side of not giving those things. So basically what you identified here was the foods that really feed candida are carbohydrates. They can even be the sort of whole food form of carbohydrates, all sugars, especially you know, refined sugars, fruit and things like that, but also alcohol as being a major one there. And that it looks like, you know, in terms of treating candida, most of the kind of anti-candida diets out there, whether we mentioned body ecology, GAPS, there's a whole range of different ones out there, are really looking to remove the sugar from people's diets. And what have you found that when you get people on a diet like that, any, I know it's probably different for every person depending on what their overgrowth is like, but how long do you generally put people on? And do you cut out all sugar or keep a little bit in there?
So those are all great questions. And again, people that are seeing me that are doing this under the guidance of me or me and my nutritionist. And so, and being a physician, I have the ability to write for antifungal medications. And by the time people get to me, they've been either, you know, been dealing with this and not knowing what it was, or like yourself, trying to do it on their own. And by the time they get to me, they're ready for the, you know, for the big guns. So when you're doing it on your own and trying to do it either just with diet, or let me just say, there are sort of three ways to attack this. There's diet alone, there's diet plus some herbal remedies, which we can talk about, and then there's diet plus herbal remedies and actual prescription antifungal medications. I opt for number three because I can, and because of the people that are coming to see me typically want that. Now, occasionally I get somebody who doesn't, and we opt for number two, which is diet and, you know, some herbal remedies. Diet is the key component. If you're only going to do diet alone, it could take you a year. I mean, I have people, you know, it really can take a long time, 6 months or a year. If you're doing diet and herbal, yes, of course, it all depends on, you know, what the level is. And then, you know, we can even talk about other risk factors like mercury, mycotoxins in their home. There are other things that can keep that candida there, even though somebody's on a very strict candida diet. But, you know, assuming they don't have these other things and it's really just had been diet driven, diet and herbal supplements, several months. When I use diet herbal supplements and antifungals, I typically have them do it for 6 weeks and then we recheck. And then, of course, we use their symptoms as a guide. For many people, that's it. They don't need more. For other people, it just, you know, kind of keeps coming back and we got to figure out, did they slip on the diet? Do they have heavy metals in their system? Do they have mycotoxins in their environment? You know, why is this keep coming back? So if somebody keeps coming back after they've been through a pretty strict diet, herbal supplements, and antifungals, you know, there's something else going on. Mm. In terms of the diet that we have them use, we say 1 cup of grains and 1 cup of fruit. So there are diets out there that are extremely strict, absolutely no grains, no fruits. Again, I think those are more geared towards people who are really trying to do this on their own and are not, you know, taking an antifungal along with it. We're a little, we're very strict on it, but a little less so than maybe some of the things that you might see on the internet, because people have the benefit of getting the, you know, antifungal medication from me.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So that it might actually be necessary if someone's doing it on their own to remove, let's say, all forms of sugar for a period of time. But if you have the benefit of being able to use fluconazole or diflucan or some of these great antifungals, I say great just because I took them. I've done two treatments of them and found them very useful. Very, very quickly, I found that one of the things that really cleared up was brain fog.
Yeah, that is the biggest thing that I hear. I mean, it is amazing. I would say there are two, probably three, quote unquote, drugs in my office, and the only ones that I write for are very powerful, giving menopausal women on progesterone and they sleep and they think I'm a godsend, natural progesterone. The other thyroid medication, particularly T3, as we talked about in the last podcast, you know, just people that, you know, weight and energy and all that other stuff. And then the third one is absolutely an antifungal. That brain fog, depression, anxiety, I mean, it can be overnight for people. And so that's why I use it. And back to what I mentioned about the medications and the viruses, parasites, fungi, and bacteria, that antifungal medicines are very specific to the fungus. And so it should not disrupt the bacteria or kill any of the good bacteria. So it is nice in that way. And that's the other reason that I like it over some of the herbal things, because some of the herbal supplements, which can be great, are non-specific. So something like oil of oregano, it kills the good bacteria, it kills the parasites, it kills the yeast. It's really good at doing all of those things. So the only sort of downside of the antifungals is that it is hard on the liver. But I check everybody's liver beforehand. I let everybody know that if they're having any sort of problem, to let us know. We will check their liver enzymes immediately. And then I put people on a what we call, it's called liver support in my store. And that's, you know, just a milk thistle and alpha lipoic acid supplement to just help support the liver in detoxing while they're on the antifungals. So I'm very, very careful about it. And I've never had anybody with a problem.
Okay, interesting. And you said too that for in general, you usually put people on this program for about 6 weeks.
Well, I put people on the program for about 6 weeks. I mean, typically what is a scenario in my office is that people end up having some sort of parasite as well. So let me back up. When you come to see me, if I'm highly suspecting it, you know, you're going through our Myers Way program, I will mention to my nutritionist that I want them on the candidal part. We have various parts of the Myers Way program, and I have put them on the candida one, which is, of course, lower carbs and sugars or fruits. We don't have sugars on the program as it is, but fruits. And I'll go ahead and start somebody on, and we'll get into the treatments, but I'll go ahead and start somebody on some caprylic acid that comes from coconut oil. It's very, very safe. There is, you know, no side effect that I'm aware of. And so if you didn't have candida, it's no problem. And so I will day one, if it's highly suspected of somebody, you know, have them already on that diet and get them on some caprylic acid before we even get their stool test back. So then I see them back in 6 weeks. So they might have already been doing this for 6 weeks, and then they come in, and then, you know, we find out you do have candida, and then we'll hit it hard with the, you know, with the antifungal medication at that point. So, you know, if we didn't suspect it and we're uncovering it at the follow-up visit, then we will at that point start for 6 weeks the diet, the caprylic acid, and then you'll take the antifungal medication for a month.
Okay, and that caprylic acid is one of the natural antifungals. Is it nonspecific as well, or?
Yeah, so it has, well, you know, coconut oil, which is where this caprylic acid comes from, has various healing properties, which is one of the reasons that it's such a great oil to use, in that it has antiviral properties to it. It has antifungal properties to it. So it can be overall just a good thing for immune health. Now, you'd have to eat a lot of coconut oil to get the caprylic acid out of it. So it's generally relatively cheap. It's effective. It's safe. So, you know, we have some on our store. It's literally just caprylic acid. So we just, you know, it's just sort of a no-brainer. You can eat coconut oil as well, and that can be great for general health. You just have to eat a lot of the oil. Why not take out the, you know, the actual component or ingredient in the oil that they've found to be, you know, antifungal?
Cool. So, Amy, I think you mentioned it there, but so if people want to find out kind of your version of dealing with candida, both from the diet side and both from the supplement side, where can they find that?
So the diet side would be our ebook, The Myers Way, and the main ebook, which is the elimination diet. We have a candida protocol in there. We're actually going to be doing a very specific candida ebook as well, but that's not up quite yet. And then we have some gut packages on our website as well that you can just go under gut health or under packages, and there would be, I think there's one for candida and just overall gut health. So the one other supplement that we didn't mention, caprylic acid, totally safe for everybody. I mean, even kids, not a problem. Everybody can take it. You know, if you don't have yeast, not going to hurt you. The other supplement that I use is something called GI Microbics that has some other herbs in it, which would be like berberine, which is golden seal. It's a whole host of products. And I do use that as well sometimes for people, but it gets back to that oil of oregano situation where they're not quite as specific to yeast. But certainly if somebody doesn't want to do an antifungal, I'll put them on that. That, you know, there are some of those herbs. The great thing about herbs is they can be very helpful and they're all natural, but herbs can be harmful as well. So you have to be very careful. And so there are some kind of strong herbs in there that, you know, I wouldn't just, you know, recommend anybody just take them. I usually kind of would like a conversation with the person, make sure nothing else is going on, very cautious in children with that. But there is another, you know, genuinely herbal product that I use as well called GI Microbics.
Great. All right, Amy, well, we're here at the end of our Candida podcast. for someone who might be suspecting that they have some of these symptoms that could be candida related, as a kind of endpoint, how would you recommend they get started on this path?
So diet, number one, absolutely. Two, I would, it depends on whether they're going to try to go get a test from somebody or not in hopes of getting some antifungals. If you are, then I would not start something, you know, like the caprylic acid, because it could certainly interfere with the test. But if you're planning on trying to do this on your own, I'd get some caprylic acid. I would do that program for 2 to 3 months. And certainly if anybody's needing any extra support, my nutritionist, Breanne Herman, who's a registered dietitian, can chat with you guys on the phone. She does wellness consultations. If you buy our ebook, you can hop on over to our special Facebook page, The Myers Way, and she's there daily answering questions as well. And of course, anybody's welcome to come see me as a patient.
Great. All right, Amy. Well, thanks so much for sharing.
Thanks, John.
To stay in touch with Dr. Myers, you can sign up for her newsletter on her website at dramymyers.com or connect with her on Facebook or Twitter at Amy Myers, MD.